342, Chapter 17, Book Talk begins at 8 minutes and 45 seconds. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 342, The Van Approacheth. This episode brought to you by Little Acorn Creations, handmade accessories for heart and home. And Knit Circus, the e-newsletter delivered to your mailbox, bringing you three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more at www.knitcircus.com. And March Hare Yarns, hand-dyed yarn just for you. You can visit the March Hare at Etsy. And Pennywise Consulting, technology solutions for your small business. Links to all of our sponsors' pages can be found in the show notes at craftlit.com. Remember, their support for the show is what keeps it free for you. So go take a look. All right, so this week we have Chapter 17, but I do have a couple of things to share with you. Number one, don't forget we have a raffle through the end of May for the lovely book, Knitted Mitts and Mittens by Amy Gunderson, and you can find out all sorts of stuff about it, both from the raffle page that you can get to from the show notes for episode 342. It'll be at the top. It'll be a link. And also, I did a blog post over at mamaoknits.com last week about the book. So more details are there if you want to take a look before signing up for the raffle. I also wanted to alert you, if you are a knitter, you have probably heard of Project Knitwell, knitting with a purpose, wellness, comfort, and community. They have released a guide, a resource guide for young knitters, written by Julia Staron, S-T-A-R-O-N, and it was written by a kid. Well, she's 19 now, but written by a kid. It's a lovely little pamphlet book for how to teach kids how to knit. And I'll read you the little preface to the guide. It says, Project Knitwell is a nonprofit organization that aims to bring the joy of knitting to persons facing difficult situations. Currently, it is available to patients, family members, and healthcare providers at several hospitals and in after-school programs for at-risk youth in the Metro Washington, D.C. area. On an individual basis or in a group setting, volunteers teach participants how to knit. They receive a complimentary beginner's kit, which includes yarn needles and a knitting resource guide. Once basic skills are mastered, knitters can then select among several project kits. Volunteers again provide the materials and instruction for them to complete their project. If you would like more information about Project Knitwell, please visit our website or email us at info@knitwell.org, which is all one word, and the website is www.projectknitwell.org. Nice, smart, and great little booklet. I bought it at my local yarn store, Uniquities, where I'll be speaking in June, and there's no information inside it on how to get your own copy. But I am here to tell you that if you visit their website and click on the link at the top that says Publications, you will find everything you need to know about procuring copies for your own community. It's a really good little resource guide. And if you have been lucky enough to see my talk on cognitive anchoring, you know from seeing my slides and hearing what I had to say that this kind of thing in a city school cannot be undervalued. It is so good, important, smart, kind to get this information, how to do something that is both calming and productive into the hands of teenagers. So important. So I was very, very happy to find that guide. I also wanted to share with you just quickly, I know I said I wasn't going to do this because I didn't think I'd have anything in time, but I forgot to mention it on 341. So here we go on 342. I met an author and an artist just kind of accidentally at a store, and we started talking, and it was very interesting. The author is a mom who had a mom blog, and that grew into a book called Epic Mom. It's available at Amazon. Her name is Julie Harrison, and she was just great and interesting and funny. And so there's a link to her book in the show notes, because why not? But I had been listening to her, to Julie, speaking to another woman. They both worked at this shop, and I'd been while I was kind of puttering around looking. This was one of those kind of antique-y shops that has lots of interesting stuff. Some of it modern, some of it crafty, Etsy kind of stuff. Some of it antiques that people have brought in on consignment. And so, you know, it's easy to spend a lot of time just looking in a store like that. And as I'm puttering around, I'm listening to them. And they're both very interesting people. And Laura's history was fascinating. But what made her even more interesting is that she is a Byzantine icon painter. And it turns out that this is a whole thing. I went looking for pictures that she had painted on the web because she has a lovely brochure. And then I started looking for images, and that led me to site after site of people who paint Byzantine iconography. So it's that kind of flat, you know, pre-understanding perspective and facial perspective, those kind of flat paintings that are, I don't know what it is about them. They feel reverent to me. They just do. I don't know if it's the gold leaf. I don't know if it's the style. I don't know if it's just that when I saw that style for the first time, this is what it meant. I don't know. But her stuff is beautiful. And so while we're standing there talking and sharing, you know, oh, I have a podcast and oh, this is what it is. And here's a postcard. You can see all the books we've done. I started asking her questions about her art. And she said, oh, well, I have some stuff upstairs if you want to see it. So I thought, woohoo. I ran upstairs after her and I took a picture of her in front of some of her art. And I think you will be very, very impressed. Her stuff is lovely. And she does do commission work. So if there is something you are particularly craving or that you have a yen for, I'll make sure that you can get in touch with her from the show notes for episode 342. Because how cool is that? So there we are. I thought this was going to be an episode completely devoid of all things crafty, and yet it had more craftiness than 341. Go figure. Life is weird. And the last weird thing, before we get to the book, I think I have a vague memory that I announced this before, but I now have actual information for you. YouTube. Technology has finally caught up in such a way that I am able to put the podcasts out quite easily onto YouTube. And I had to jump through some hoops in order to get it to happen because the podcast episodes are longer than 15 minutes. But hoops have been jumped, things have been through, and I put the first episode of North and South up about a week ago. I wanted to make sure that it worked. And now I am slowly uploading everything to date for North and South. At some point, all of the Craftlit podcasts for all of the books will be up on YouTube. I have come to understand that some people really like to listen to things that way. So there it is. That's what we're going to do. And it'll just be an additional source. So if you have friends who prefer YouTube, it'll be there now. So chapter 17 of North and South. Last chapter, you may recall, ended very interestingly with Dixon stopping mid-sentence. The punctuation is actually an M dash, that long double dash, and an exclamation point, because she kind of cuts off mid-thought. Probably she had to go do something. So today's chapter will pick up with Margaret leaving the house, and she's going to go for a walk. And anytime she's out in Milton, you can be fairly confident, just like in Bleak House, anytime you have a chapter that has Joe in it, you are fairly confident that there will be at least a few slang terms that do not get used today, at least not in the United States. I don't know, they might still get used somewhere in the UK, but if they do, please put a note in the comments. I would be very curious to know which of these words is still in use. I have a sneaking suspicion about one of them, but first, I thought I would wait and go over the words right before we listen to the book so that they're fresh in your head. And whereas last week's chapter was full of, or at least bookended by, two pretty important internal monologues, the post Dr. Donaldson conversation and the Dixon monologue, this week is all dialogue. There's a little bit of description at the beginning, but there's some really great dialogue going on between the characters in this chapter. And we're finally able to put some of the pieces together about how Margaret is starting to see things. I was about to say more clearly, and I suppose it's true more clearly, but I think we are therefore also starting to see things more clearly. And that's probably even more important because we've heard the master's side of strike talk. We've heard his mother's side of the strike talk as well. But we heard Mr. Thornton a couple of chapters ago talking about this. And so we know how he feels about it. And we've heard Margaret talking about the South and how idyllic and perfect and Eden-like the whole place is. And we haven't really gotten any contrasting, opposing viewpoints added into the mix yet. And today we start to. And particularly remembering that Elizabeth Gaskell was not a native of this area, which gave her that wonderful outsider perspective, I am vastly impressed by this chapter and a few more that are coming up, because it seems to me that getting to know a mill town in northern England at this time would have been quite difficult. And then trying to represent that mill town's thoughts and ways of seeing things to an outside world, to a London audience, first and foremost, because you want sales in London to be good. And Dickens certainly would have wanted that you would have to be very cautious about the way that you present the hands. There's the master and there's the hands, which is, as you might imagine, kind of insulting to the hands, you think? They're not slaves, but they're only hands. They're not actually men. I'd always heard the term field hand when I was growing up, and somehow that doesn't seem quite as offensive as just calling a man a hand. These are my hands, all 520 of them who work in my mill. It's creepy, and you can really see how it would wear thin. And so we're going to start seeing the light through the chink in the stone wall of that particular thorny issue. And we'll have more to talk about the implications on the flip side, but the language that I wanted to give you before we get into the chapter, dang, D-A-N-G, we're used to dang being kind of like darn it in the United States. And in this context, to dang someone would be to defeat them. And it would usually be kind of violently. So that was a serious thing. I think we mentioned this one before, the word clem, C-L-E-M, is starving. So clemmed to death would be starved to death. You'll hear a lot of clemming talking about in this chapter. Factory age. A child was factory age if they were 9 years old or older. A child 9 years old or younger was too young to work in the factory by law. So things have changed a little bit since then. Abated wage would be an abated wage, which would be a reduced wage. Knobsticks, K-N-O-B-S-T-I-C-K-S. Knobsticks is the term that they used back then for strikebreakers or scabs. I don't know if that term is still in use or if the ever so lovely scabs has replaced it, but that's that you're going to hear knobsticks quite a bit, not just in this chapter, but for the rest of the book. So that'll pop up again. If you say something be farred, it would be like something be blowed, or that's nonsense. Don't pay any attention to that. A fillip is an F-I-L-L-I-P, and that's like something that perks you up. a little fill-up. I don't know if that's like fill-up or something else. I couldn't find a reference for it. If you find one, please let us know. There's a reference to buying a 4-pounder. I had no idea what that was. It's buying a 4-pound loaf of bread, which would be A, special because you're buying it somewhere else, and B, special because it's big. It's a big loaf of bread. And then we have a couple of references to the book of Revelation. Oh, that probably tells you exactly where we're going to go in this chapter, doesn't it? I went back and forth. I actually think I kind of think it's important to know these going in when you listen to the chapter the first time. And it's important, I think, because in today's chapter, you can start to understand why Bessie is so taken with the book of Revelation. In today's chapter, she is going to reference chapter 8, verse 11. She's not going to call it out by its call letters, but she is going to read it. And just to give you a important heads up on this, the part that she talks about is, "And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, and men died of the waters because they were made bitter." So this is during the first four trumpets, when the first four angels appear and blow their trumpets, and they're starting everything. They're getting it all going. And there is, as you might expect with the book of Revelations, a whole interesting host of interpretations that people have come up with over the last 2,000 years for what this means. And the important thing here is what Bessie says before, which is, in a nutshot, sometimes when I'm really sad, it helps for me to think that this was planned, that I drank the wormwood water, and that's why I'm dying. Because if it's prophesied, then that's very different from a meaningless, accidental, sad, tragic death of a good person. Now it's a holy war. It's an opportunity. You've made it through, and your reward isn't just coming, it's imminent. And that's a very different way of thinking about what she knows is coming. And in fact, she goes on and later references very specifically the seventh chapter. And the seventh chapter is when you get the description of the great multitude that's clad in white robes who stand before the throne of God. One of the translations is, "These are they which came out of the great tribulation and have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb." I think that's chapter 7, verse 14. And so you can see, it's like, I've been through all of this. I have been through hell, and I've come out the other side pure and clean and ready to spend the rest of eternity with God. And you can't fault her for that. And of course, the interesting thing is watching Margaret respond to this, because we already know what Margaret thinks of the book of Revelation. Not her favorite book. The other term that we've talked about before on the podcast, but never quite in this context, is fustian. Fustian cloth, F-U-S-T-I-A-N. It was really low-grade cotton woven cloth. Probably had vegetable matter in it. Very nubby, not very fine at all, and wouldn't be a whole lot of fun to work with, much less cut. And you'll hear about somebody who's off fustian cutting. They're doing piecework. So that will come up in this chapter as well. And now I'm going to let you listen. There's more important stuff to talk about at the end, but now I feel like you're prepared for getting all the subtext of what's going on in today's chapter, chapter 17.
Chapter 17. What is a strike? There are briars besetting every path, which call for patient care. There is a cross in every lot, and an earnest need for prayer. Anonymous. Margaret went out heavily and unwillingly enough. But the length of a street, yes, the air of a Milton Street, cheered her young blood before she reached her first turning. Her step grew lighter, her lip redder. She began to take notice instead of having her thoughts turned so exclusively inward. She saw unusual loiterers in the streets, men with their hands in their pockets sauntering along, loud laughing and loud-spoken girls clustered together, apparently excited to high spirits and a boisterous independence of temper and behavior. The more ill-looking of the men, the discreditable minority, hung about on the steps of the beer houses and gin shops, smoking and commenting pretty freely on every passerby. Margaret disliked the prospect of the long walk through these streets before she came to the fields which she had planned to reach. Instead, she would go and see Bessie Higgins. It would not be so refreshing as a quiet country walk, but still, it would perhaps be doing the kinder thing. Nicholas Higgins was sitting by the fire smoking as she went in. Bessie was rocking herself on the other side. Nicholas took the pipe out of his mouth and, standing up, pushed his chair towards Margaret. He leant against the chimney-piece in a lounging attitude, while she asked Bessie how she was.
"As rather down in the mouth in regards to spirits, but as bitter in health. Doesn't like this strike. There's a deal too much set on pace and quietness at any price."
"This is the third strike I've seen," said she, sighing, as if that was answer and explanation enough.
"Well, third time pays for all. See if we don't dang the masters this time. See if they don't come and beg us to come back at our own price. That's all. We've missed it aforetime, I grant you, but this time we'd laid our plans desperate deep."
"Why do you strike?" asked Margaret. "Striking is leaving off work till you get your own rate of wages, is it not? You must not wonder at my ignorance. Where I come from, I never heard of a strike."
"I wish I were there," said Bessie wearily. "But it's not for me to get sick and tired of strikes. This is the last I'll see. Before it's ended, I shall be in the great city, the Holy Jerusalem."
So full of the life to come, I cannot think of the present. Now I, you see, am bound to do the best I can here. I think a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush. So, them's the different views we take on the strike question."
"But," said Margaret, "if the people struck, as you call it, where I come from, as they are mostly all field labourers, the seed would not be sown, the hay got in, the corn reaped."
"Well," said he.
He had resumed his pipe and put his "well" in the form of an interrogation.
"Why," she went on, "what would become of the farmers?"
He puffed away.
"I reckon they'd have either to give up their farms or to give fair rate of wage."
"Suppose they could not or would not do the last. They could not give up their farms all in a minute, however much they might wish to do so, but they would have no hay nor corn to sell that year. And where would the money come from to pay the laborer's wages the next?"
Still puffing away, at last he said,
"I know naught of your ways down south. I have heard they're a pack of spiritless, downtrodden men, welly clemmed to death, too much dazed with clemming to know when they're put upon. Now, it's not so here. We known when we're put upon, and when too much blood in us to stand it. We just take our hands for our looms and say, 'You may claim us, but you'll not put upon us, me masters.' And be danged to 'em, they shan't this time."
"I wish I lived down south," said Bessie.
"There's a deal to bear there," said Margaret. "There are sorrows to bear everywhere. There is very hard bodily labour to be gone through, with very little food to give strength."
"But it's out of doors," said Bessie, "and away from the endless, endless noise and sickening heat."
"It's sometimes in heavy rain, and sometimes in bitter cold. A young person can stand it, but an old man gets racked with rheumatism and bent and withered before his time. Yet he must just work on the same, or else go to the workhouse.
I thought you were so taken with the ways of the South Country.
So I am, said Margaret, smiling a little as she found herself thus caught. I only mean, Bessie, there's good and bad in everything in this world, and as you felt the bad up here, I thought it was but fair you should know the bad down there.
And you say they never strike down there? Asked Nicholas abruptly.
No, said Margaret. I think they have too much sense.
And I think, replied he, dashing the ashes out of his pipe with so much vehemence that it broke, it's not that they have too much sense, but that they have too little spirit.
Oh, father, said Bessie, what have ye gained by striking? Think of that first strike, when mother died. Are we all had to clem? You're the worst of all, and yet many a one went in every week at the same wage, till all were gone in that there was work for, and some went beggars all their lives at after.
Aye, said he, that their strike was badly managed. Folk got into the management of it, as were either fools or not true men. You see, it'll be different this time.
But all this time you've not told me what you're striking for, said Margaret again.
Well, you see, there's 5 or 6 masters who have set themselves again paying the wages they've been paying these 2 years past, and flourishing upon, and getting richer upon. And now they come to us and say we're to take less, and we won't. We'll just clem them to death first, and see who'll work for 'em then. They'll have killed the goose that laid 'em the golden eggs, I reckon.
And so you plan dying in order to be revenged upon them?
No, said he, I do not. I just look forward to the chance of dying at my post sooner than yield. That's what folk call fine and honourable in a soldier, and why not in a poor weaver chap?
But, said Margaret, a soldier dies in the cause of the nation, in the cause of others.
He laughed grimly. My lass, said he, you're but a young wench, and don't you think I can keep 3 people, that's Bessie and Mary and me, on 16 shilling a week? Don't you think it's for myself I'm striking work at this time? It's just as much in the cause of others as yon soldier, only, mayhappen, the cause he dies for is just that of somebody he never clapped eyes on, nor heard on all his born days, while I take up John Busher's cause, as lives next door but one with a sickly wife and 8 children, none of 'em on factory age. And I don't take up his cause only, though he's a poor good for naught, as can only manage 2 looms at a time, but I take up the cause of justice. Why are we to have less wage now, I ask, than 2 years ago?
Don't ask me, said Margaret. I am very ignorant. Ask some of your masters. Surely they will give you a reason for it. It is not merely an arbitrary decision of theirs come to without reason.
You're just a foreigner and nothing more, said he contemptuously. Much you know about it. Ask the masters. They'd tell us to mind our own business, and then they'd mind theirs. Our business being, you understand, to take the baited wage and be thankful, and their business to bait us down to Clement Point to swell their profits. That's what it is.
But, said Margaret, determined not to give way, although she saw she was irritating him, the state of trade may be such as not to enable them to give you the same remuneration.
State of trade. That's just a piece old master's humbug. It's rate of wages I was talking of. The masters keep the state of trade in their own hands and just walk it forward like a black bugaboo to frighten naughty children with into being good. I'll tell you it's their part, their cue, as some folks call it, to beat us down, to swell their fortunes, and it's ours to stand up and fight hard. Not for ourselves alone, but for them round about us, for justice and fair play. We help to make their profits, and we ought to help spend them. It's not that we want their brass so much this time, as we've done many a time afore. We're in getting money laid by, and we resolve to stand and fall together. Not a man on us will go in for less wage than the union says is our due. So, I say, hooray for the strike, and let Thornton and Slickson and Hamper and their set look to it.
Thornton, said Margaret. Mr. Thornton of Marlborough Street?
Aye, Thornton of Marlborough Mill, as we call him.
He is one of the masters you are striving with, is he not? What sort of master is he?
Did you ever see a bulldog? Set a bulldog on hind legs and dress him up in coat and breeches and you're just getting John Thornton.
Nay, said Margaret, laughing, I deny that. Mr. Thornton is plain enough, but he's not like a bulldog with its short, broad nose and snarling upper lip.
No, not in look, I grant you, but let John Thornton get old on a notion, and he'll stick to it like a bulldog. You might pull him away with the pitchfork ere he'd leave go. He's worth fighting with, is John Thornton. As for Slickson, I take it some of these days he'll wheedle his men back with fair promises that they'll just get cheated out of as soon as they're in his power again. He'll work his fines well out on him, I'll warrant. He's as slippery as an eel, he is. He's like a cat, as sleek and cunning and fierce. It'll never be an honest up-and-down fight with him as it will be with Thornton. Thornton's as dour as a doornail, an obstinate chap every inch on him, the old bulldog.
Poor Bessie, said Margaret, turning round to her. You sigh over it all. You don't like struggling and fighting as your father does, do you?
No, said she heavily. I'm sick on it. I could have wished to have had other talk about me in my latter days than just the clashing and clanging and clattering that is wearied on my life long about work and wages and masters and hands and knobsticks.
Poor wench, latter days be fired. Thou'rt looking a sight better already for a little stir and change. Be sad, I shall be a deal here to make it more lively for thee.
Tobacco smoke chokes me, said she querulously.
Then I'll never smoke no more in the house, he replied tenderly. But why didst thou not tell me afore, thou foolish wench?
She did not speak for a while, and then so low that only Margaret heard her.
I reckon he'll want all the comfort he can get out of either pipe or drink afore he's done.
Her father went out of doors, evidently to finish his pipe. Bessie said passionately,
No, am I not a fool, am I not, miss? There, I knew I ought for to keep father at home and away from the folk that are always ready for to tempt a man in time of strike to go drink. And then my tongue must needs quarrel with this pipe boy, isn't? And he'll go off, I know he will, as often as he wants to smoke, and nobody knows where it'll end. I wish I'd letten myself be choked first.
But does your father drink? Asked Margaret.
No, not to say drink, replied she,
still in the same wild, excited tone.
But what when you have? There are days, with you as we other folk, I suppose, when you get up and go through the hours just longing for a bit of change, a bit of a fillip, as it were. I know I had gone and bought a 4-pounder out of another baker's shop to come in on such days, just because I sickened at the thought of going on forever with the same sight in my eyes, and the same sound in my ears, and the same taste in my mouth, and the same thought, or no thought for that matter, in my head, day after day forever. I've longed for to be a man to go spreeing, even if it were only a tramp to some new place in search of work. And father, all men have it stronger in them than me to get tired of sameness and work forever. And what is em to do? It's little blame to them if they do go into the gin shop for to make their blood flow quicker and more lively,
and see things they never see at no other time. Pictures and looking glass and such like. But father never was a drunkard, though maybe he's got worse for drink now and then. Only, you see,
and now her voice took a mournful, pleading tone,
at times so strike there's much to knock a man down, for all they start so hopefully, and where's the comfort to come from? He'll get angry and mad, they all do, and then they get tired out with being angry and mad, and maybe had done things in their passion they'd be glad to forget. Bless your sweet, pitiful face, but you do not know what a strike is yet.
Come, Bessie, said Margaret. I won't say you're exaggerating, because I don't know enough about it, but perhaps as you're not well, you're only looking on one side, and there is another and a brighter to be looked to.
It's all well enough for you to say so. I've lived in pleasant green places all your life long, and never known want or care or wickedness either, for that matter.
Take care, said Margaret, her cheek flushing and her eye lightening. How you judge, Bessie?
I shall go home to my mother, who is so ill, Bessie, that there's no outlet but death for her out of the prison of a great suffering. And yet I must speak cheerfully to my father, who has no notion of her real state, and to whom the knowledge must come gradually. The only person, the only one who could sympathize with me and help me, whose presence could comfort my mother more than any other earthly thing, is falsely accused, would run the risk of death if he came to see his dying mother. This I tell you, only you, Bessie. You must not mention it. No other person in Milton, hardly any other person in England, knows. Have I not care? Do I not know anxiety, though I go about well-dressed and have food enough? Oh, Bessie, God is just, and our lots are well portioned out by him, although none but he knows the bitterness of our souls.
I ask your pardon, replied Bessie humbly. Sometimes, when I've thought of my life and the little pleasures I've had in it, I've believed that maybe I was one of those doomed to die by the falling of a star from heaven. And the name of the star is called Wormwood, and the third part of the waters became wormwood, and men died of the waters because they were made bitter. One can bear pain and sorrow better if one thinks it has been prophesied long before for one. Somehow, then it seems as if my pain was needed for the fulfillment. Otherwise, it seems all sent for nothing.
Nay, Bessie, think, said Margaret. God does not willingly afflict. Don't dwell so much on the prophecies, but read the clearer parts of the Bible.
I dare say it would be wiser, but where would I hear such grand words of promise, hear tell or anything far different from this drear world and this town above all as in Revelations? Many is the time I've repeated the verses in the 7th chapter to myself, just for the sound. It's as good as an organ, and as different from every day, too. No, I cannot give up Revelations. It gives me more comfort than any other book in the Bible.
Let me come and read you some of my favourite chapters.
Aye, said she greedily. Come, father will maybe hear you. He is deaved with my talking. He says it's all naught to do with the things of today, and that's his business.
Where is your sister?
Gone fustian cutting. I were loath to let her go, but somehow we must live, and the union can't afford us much.
Now I must go. You have done me good, Bessie.
I done you good?
Yes, I came here very sad, and rather too apt to think my own cause for grief was the only one in the world. And now I hear how you have had to bear for years, and that makes me stronger.
Bless you, I thought the good doing was on the side of the gentlefolk. I shall get proud if I think I can do good to you.
You won't do it if you think about it, but you'll only puzzle yourself if you do. That's one comfort.
You're not like no one I ever seed. I don't know what to make you.
Nor I of myself. Goodbye.
Bessie stilled her rocking to gaze after her.
I wonder if there are many folk like her down south. She's like a breath of country air somehow. She freshens me up above a bit. Who'd have thought that face, as bright and as strong as the angel I could dream of, could have known the sorrow she speaks on? I wonder how she'll sin. All on us must sin. I think a deal on her for sure, but Father does the like, I see, and Mary even. It's not often her stirred up to notice much.
So, as large an impact as Milton has had on Margaret, Margaret is starting to have on Milton. And wasn't the scene with Bessie and her father, and when he discovers that she doesn't like pipes, gets up and leaves so she doesn't have to smell his pipe anymore. And his getting up and giving Margaret his chair without asking, without looking askance, without having an issue. He's a good guy. He's a good guy. And Bessie, sweet Bessie. It makes sense right now, right? The revelation thing, now that you've heard the whole chapter laid out in front of you. And finally, we have started to hear some negative things out of Margaret's mouth about the South. And the conversation parallels between Margaret and Higgins and Margaret and Thornton when it comes to discussing business and work and masters in hands and labor. It's marvelous the way Gaskell has crafted this opportunity for us to be spectators. It's almost like, you know, watching a tennis match. It's on this side and on that side. Just keep going back and forth and back and forth, but it works. And we're learning a lot. And then also, not only hearing about the South, something negative about the South, but hearing about the Union and hearing Higgins' version of what the Union is doing and why, and then hearing Bessie's version, having watched a couple of strikes now, what the Union does and the impact of what the Union does on regular people like her, not factory hands. It is complicated stuff. And in fact, I don't know if this will still be roiling when the podcast comes out, but there's been all sorts of hubbub in the United States because the Congress voted down some law that I guess in some ways looks like the Equal Rights Amendment that didn't pass in the 70s. I didn't really understand what was going on, and I wasn't entirely clear on why it got voted down. But then I saw somebody in a comments section of a post, it was on Facebook or on somebody's blog, that someone said, look, I don't know what the hubbub is about all of this. The law was passed in 1963, equal pay for equal work. Everybody can shut up now. And I went, what? Because I remember reading the Equal Rights Amendment when I was a kid thinking, well, sure, you should get paid the same. If you're qualified the same and doing the same work, you should all be getting the same base salary. Kind of duh. But I went to hunting and found that, yeah, in 1963, there was a law that was passed that was supposed to have taken care of this problem, which is fascinating because 63, civil rights and everything. And here's this bill that's supposed to protect women. And for some reason, either it didn't work or wasn't enforceable, or people are just deciding to make a brouhaha now. I don't know. I do know that there have been times in my life when I was offered a ridiculously small amount of money. And I know that men who were offered the same job, who were less qualified than me, were offered more money. I had not taken the job at that point, but so I know it happens, but I am hoping that one of our lawyer listeners, of whom I know there are many, and you guys are awesome, I hope one of you understands and can explain what just happened. What happened in 63? What happened in, what was it, 76, 77, when the Equal Rights Amendment was supposed to go up for a vote and got voted down? And then what just happened now? Because I'm seeing very interesting conversations, non-conversations happening. Again, because we think we know who the other person is and we're talking to our picture, our straw man of that person instead of actually what they're saying. And there's a lot of shrill kind of snarking going on. But there seems to be two conversations and I can't tell which one actually applies. And I've seen them, the two conversations go like this. One, of course, women make less money than men. A certain percentage of the women in the United States are home with kids, or they're work-at-home moms or stay-at-home moms, and they're not in the workforce. So, of course, statistically, women make less than men in this country. That is not something you can legislate, because then you'd be legislating that everybody has to go out and get a salaried position, and that's ridiculous. Okay, so that's fine. But I didn't think that that was what the bill was about. I thought the bill was about, like, the Lilly Ledbetter thing, where you have somebody who is equally qualified, different genders, but same qualifications, same work experience, same education, same job performance, all of that stuff. All things being equal, a woman's salary, base salary, is consistently often lower than the men's. And I know when I was offered this extraordinarily, shockingly low wage, and I balked and said, really? You're serious? The response to me was, well, what does your husband do? And I'm not joking. That was 1995. So not ancient history. Actually, for some of you, that probably is ancient history. It doesn't feel like ancient history to me. Some of you were knee-high to a grasshopper back then. So I can't figure out what all the hubbub is about, and I'm hoping somebody can explain it, because it seems to me that it's kind of beautifully dovetailing up with what's going on in North and South, that you have the masters who, as Thornton says, if he were a working man, he would not want his boss telling him what to do with his time or his money. And that, additionally, he doesn't have to explain the business side of things to the men. They should trust him to do his job, which is run the place, and he trusts them to do their job, which is the labor. And there's a division of labor, and for a good reason. And clearly there's some snobbery going on here. It's not a huge surprise. And then from the laborer's side of things, they don't care that it's a good year or a bad year. They want to make a living wage to feed their family on. And what they're seeing from the outside is the masters stay rich no matter what is happening with the price of cotton, or the price of bringing the cotton in, or the price that they can get for the cotton once it's spun and woven and everything. They don't care. They just want to make enough money to feed their family. And it does seem that people keep talking at cross purposes because they think they know who they're talking to, and they've made pretty grand assumptions about motives, and maybe not so much. So we're definitely going to hear more about all of this and the strike and what that means and what it will do to this community as we head further into the book. And how it affects Margaret is really wonderful. So on that note, I'm going to go move. You have a great week. I will be back and talking to you like normal next week. Take care. Have a great one. Bye. Like Craftlit? Leave us a review on iTunes, like us on Facebook, or post a link to us when you comment on literary blogs. You can listen via Stitcher Radio, craftlit.com, or via our Android, our new Windows 8, or iPhone app. You can also use the free Craftlit app to access premium subscriber content. Craftlit is and has been made possible by the support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one on.
Before Shopify, were you wondering, where are my sales at? Now you're selling with Shopify, the global commerce platform supercharging your selling. You have no problem selling online, in person, on social media, and beyond. Gary, easy on the cha-ching.
Oh, sorry, but my Shopify sales are through the roof.
Start selling with Shopify today and discover how millions of businesses around the world use Shopify to ignite their selling. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen. Shopify.com/listen.